he says with a smile, his breath tickling my cheek. We slip on our headsets, and the ground beneath us lurches. The capsule begins to shake, rattling the interior with a power that makes last week's earthquake seem modest. This can't be just a simulation. It feels too real. But the roar of an engine muffles my thoughts, and now the cockpit glass surrounding us is filling with moving 5D images, placing us at the center of a rocket barge anchored over the sea. T-minus zero, and liftoff! A voice blares from the cockpit speakers, and then we are hurtling forward, my body nearly flying out of my chair before the strap stops me. We are spinning, our bodies turning upside down with breathtaking speed as the reflection in the glass changes from a blue sky to the inky vacuum of space. Something's heading toward us, I hear Leo say. What is that? I peer closer at the glass. Looks like a used rocket stage, but if I'm right, wouldn't that kill? I break off with a shout as shards of matter come flying in our direction. Through my headset, it looks like the shards are aiming straight for my eyes, and I duck in my seat. We have to move around it, I yell as Leo grabs the pilot's joystick. Do you know how to work that thing? We're about to find out. He pushes down on the joystick and turns it to the right, sending us swerving sharply, nearly tearing out of our seats yet again. I exhale with relief as we pass the spinning shards of matter, but now, do you smell that? Leo pauses in midair as the unmistakable stench of fire fills the cockpit. And then an enormous blue flame, as tall as my own body, starts ripping through the cabin. It's not real, it's not real, I chant under my breath, but it doesn't matter what I tell myself. This moment, this danger, is as tangible as anything I've experienced before. Leo scans the capsule for a way out of the fire, and as he takes his hand off the joystick, we plunge downward. Damn it! Keep steering, I'll take care of it, I shout above the noise. He returns to the joystick, and we soar back up as I climb out of my seat and crawl through the shaking cabin, trying to escape the fire's path and yelping as the flame almost singes the back of my shirt. There has to be an extinguisher in here. There has to be, right by the door. A red fire extinguisher is mounted by the cabin door, and I yank it out of its case and start firing the water-based foam until the whole cockpit is drenched and the fire simmers to ash. Great work, Leo calls as I stumble back to the acceleration seat. And check this out. He points to the window and I catch my breath. Beginning orbit insertion to Mars, the voice echoes over our speakers. The red planet looms below us, a massive, bright orb. Up ahead, rotating around Mars, is a dragonfly-shaped floating satellite, the Athena's supply ship. But as I look from the scene out of the window to the scrolling numbers on the cockpit's navigation display, I spot a glaring flaw. The supply ship's coordinates don't match where it was plotted to be on our trajectory, I tell Leo, frantically swiping the tablet above my seat until I find the orbital dynamics page. You need to plug in the new numbers before we even attempt the rendezvous, or else we'll overshoot it. What? Leo's palm freezes on the joystick. But how? The fuel leak. It caused the ship's orbit to start changing. I shiver as it occurs to me. The general must be preparing us for this very scenario, one that could get far more complicated the longer the leak continues. We need to recompute our navigation to direct us to the supply ship's new coordinates now. Got it. Leo's hands fly over the touchscreen while my eyes sweep across the cockpit console, searching for the switches General Sokolov showed us in our training, the ones that deploy the robotic arm for docking. They were somewhere on the left side of the control panel. Trajectory adjustment confirmed. The voice returns. Prepare to rendezvous and deploy the Canada arm. Leo looks at me with a frenzied expression and then turns back to the joystick. Here goes nothing. He kicks up the speed as my fingers fumble with the panel, looking for the docking controls. And then, as the gravity of Mars pulls us into orbit and we match the supply ship's velocity, that's when I find the docking pane. I press the deploy button, watching in amazement as the robotic crane slowly unfurls, pulling us toward the ship. Slam! Leo and I jump as our vessel swipes against the side pane of the supply ship. We went too fast, Leo yells. Let me try again and decelerate this time. I return my fingers to the control panel, ready to send the cannon arm back into the fray. This time it works, and I feel the rush of heavy gear clanking into place as we dock. I'm just about to cheer that we did it when our capsule starts spinning once again. And now the scene before our window transforms, sending us millions of miles away in a matter of seconds. I struggle to catch my breath as we descend toward an icy, red-ridged moon, Europa. We have to land. Leo turns to me, an expression of both panic and glee in his eyes. Should I fire the thrusters now or... Now! I gasp. We need to reduce our velocity fast if we're going to make the landing. With one hand driving the joystick and his other working the switches on the pilot's dashboard, Leo activates the thrusters, which ignite with a deafening rumble. As our spacecraft pitches toward the moon's surface, I scan the control panel in front of me until I find the symbol for deploy landing gear. But when I press the button, a red alarm pops up. System failure. Are you kidding me? We're gonna miss it, Leo shouts, and through the window I can see that he is right. We're not slowing down quickly enough. We're dangerously close to skimming past Europa. Hurry! My fingers shake as I try a different tack, entering the command for initiate capsule separation. A green light illuminates the control panel, and then the voice returns over the cockpit speakers. Final stage separation and descent in 3, 2... My scream drowns out the countdown as the spacecraft splits in two. The engines and power propulsion modules fall away into the ether, while our remaining combined capsule drops hundreds of feet, our bodies flipping upside down in their seats. And then, finally, we come careening to a stop, our wheels kicking up ice. The glass screen fades to darkness as the voice over the speaker says, "Simulation completed successfully. You may remove your headsets and detach from the sensors." I pull off the VR equipment and blink in shock. It looks exactly as it did when we first climbed in with General Sokolov. There's no smoke from the fire, no water from where I doused the cabin with foam. There's not a single hint of the journey we just went on. It's as though Leo and I somehow shared the same multi-sensory dream. Leo leans back against his seat and we turn to each other in exhausted, delirious relief. "Well, that was insane," he remarks. "But we did it. We did it," I whisper. I inch closer to him, close enough to see myself reflected in his blue eyes, and the longing catches me off guard. Something electric runs through my body, something I haven't felt before. He reaches for my chin, gently tilting it toward him. I am too hopeful, too nervous to breathe. And then, softly, he brushes his lips against mine. We draw back for a split second, our foreheads pressed together and eyes locked, as if we are both taking in the magnitude of this moment. And then I pull him toward me, desperate to feel his lips on mine again. He cradles my face as he kisses me. He runs his mouth across my neck, leaving goosebumps everywhere his lips traced. It feels as though something is exploding in my chest, and suddenly, everything makes sense. I know why I've been conflicted, why my heart and mind have been pulling me in different directions. The answer was here, all along.
19. Leo. I wrap Naomi in my arms, kissing her lips, her face, her hair. I feel her responding to my every touch, her arms tightening around me as she kisses me back with urgency, like this moment is all we have. Footsteps. We spring apart, the sound outside the hatch door plunging us back down to earth. I jump out of my seat, hoping our flushed faces don't give us away, as General Sokolov bursts into the capsule. "Come on, you two, let's go. I have another sim to get through." She doesn't need to tell us twice. Naomi and I hurry to the hatch door, and right before I step through it, the General turns to meet my eyes, a warning in her gaze. But now Diana Dormer and Ami Nakamura are climbing into the capsule, and General Sokolov's attention shifts away from me onto them. "You don't think she saw, do you?" I murmur as Naomi and I step back onto the mission floor. Her blush deepens. "It looked like the camera stopped rolling once we unplugged from the sim, so I think we're safe," she whispers. "But she might have guessed something was up when she walked in. I'll be more careful next time." As soon as the words come out of my mouth, I cringe. Was that too bold of me? Assuming there will even be a next time? What if she just got caught up in the moment and doesn't want anything more? But then she glances up at me with a shy smile. "This is really happening, isn't it?" My chest swells. I lean in, whispering one last reply before we join the rest of the finalists. "I think it's been happening since the day we met." "I can't believe this is my life." The thought plays on a loop in my mind the rest of the day and into the night, as Naomi and I share covert smiles across the floor throughout training, as we float into the cafeteria on a high from our secret. I can't believe she feels the way I do. Now that the teams are disbanded, we are thankfully no longer bound to our old table assignments, meaning we don't have to endure another meal with Beckett Wolf. We join a table with Jan, Sydney, Dev, and Anna, but I'm hardly aware of the conversation. I'm too distracted by the feel of her soft hand, just barely resting against mine under the table. We spend the after-dinner hour curled up in an empty corner of the library, Naomi leaning against me as she scribbles a bunch of figures into a notebook. "What are you working on?" I ask, peering over her shoulder. I'm double-checking the algorithm coding I have to enter in order to connect my tablet to... you know. She gives me a little wink, lowering her voice. A certain machine. Oh. I feel like someone splashed cold water on my face. You mean, you still plan on following through with that? Of course. She glances up at me with a bemused expression. Why would I change my mind? Because now you have more reason to stay, I answer silently. Because maybe it's no longer worth the risk of getting caught. But I don't say any of it out loud. I just watch her brain at work, her face scrunching up in concentration as her pencil flies across the page. I walk her to her door at curfew, peering around the hallway to make sure we're alone before saying goodnight. I'm aching to kiss her again, but the blinking red light of the security camera overhead stops me. Hey, I have that book you wanted to borrow, Naomi says loudly, flashing a brief glance at the camera. Come in for just a quick sec. My insides thrill as she opens the door to her room, and I follow her inside. As soon as the door shuts behind us, she pulls me toward her, and I pin her against the wall, our hands interlacing as I move my lips across hers. She lets out a sigh, and it's almost unbearable how good this feels. I should go, I whisper, though every part of me wants to stay. Where's that book I'm supposed to be borrowing? Naomi reaches behind her, grabbing the title on her nightstand. A doorstopper-sized memoir by Dr. Greta Wagner. Just a little light reading, huh? I say with a grin. Yeah, well, it's my favorite, so keep it safe. If it's your favorite, then I'll do you one better. I'll actually read it. I lean in closer, brushing my lips against hers one last time. See you tomorrow. See you then. But a shadow crosses her face as I pull away. What is it? Nothing. I guess it's just... Her shoulders sag. Why couldn't I have met you any other way? What do you mean? I ask, tucking a lock of hair behind her ear. There's such a big chance of us getting separated at the end of this. It makes me afraid of what I feel for you, she confesses. I mean, one minute we were seeing Asher every day, and now we may never see him again. What if it's the same for us? She blinks back tears, and something tightens in my chest. It's so unfair. I know, but if we can get drafted together, or better yet, go back to L.A. together, she interrupts, giving me a meaningful look. You would love Sam and my parents, and we could have an actual life. I stop her words with a kiss. I'm not ready to contemplate getting cut. Not yet. Maybe not ever. Is it wrong of me to wonder if there's some way I can have it all? The girl and the mission? The next couple days fly by in a blur of training sessions with the General, Lieutenant Barnes, and the AIs, while my evenings are filled with Naomi. Even though neither of us shares a room anymore, we know not to risk another attempt at outsmarting the cameras and sneaking into each other's dorms. Instead, we spend every last second between dinner and curfew together, keeping up a pretense of platonic friendship in front of the others, while our eyes tell a different story. The only place we don't hold back is the telescope tower, the spot Naomi says is our safest bet for avoiding the cameras. We make it our own. The place where we can finally hold each other and kiss after hours spent an arm's length apart. I fall asleep with her sweet scent on my lips. I wake up with her face in my mind. Being with her is like flying in zero gravity, even while my feet are planted firmly on the ground. There's just one flaw to this new magic in my life. Losing her would wreck me. And the closer we get to the reveal of the final six, the more possible that scenario becomes. With T-minus 5 days left, we learn that our schedules will be shifting to mostly private training in each finalist's area of expertise. While I'll be spending these last days getting one-on-one instruction in drilling through Europa's ice crust, Naomi will be in the Mission Control Center with the Capsule Communicator, aka Capcom, deciphering coded computer messages and working flight velocity equations. It's clear to all of us what the transition to specialized training means. Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov are auditioning us for the 6 crew positions. My suspicion is confirmed when I show up to the diving pool for what I assumed was a private session, only to find Beckett there too. So I was right. The two of us are going head to head. I turn my face as soon as I see him, though I can feel his eyes boring a hole into my back. I won't acknowledge him. I won't let him psych me out. All right, my two divers, Lieutenant Barnes says cheerily, oblivious to the tension between us. Who knows the best way to drill through 30 kilometers of ice quickly in space? Am I supposed to know this? I stay quiet, hoping Beckett doesn't have the answer either. Thankfully, the lieutenant plunges ahead. A nuclear hydrothermal drill, he answers for us. Here's how it works. The underwater specialist on the final 6 will set up the drill on the landing site of Europa. Once in position and switched on, a nuclear power source in the drill will heat water and spit it back out in the form of high-powered jets to melt through the ice. At the same time, rotating drill blades beneath the water jets will chip away at the ice. He smiles. And that is how you will pierce Europa's ice shell and descend into its rocky ocean and land below. Adrenaline courses through me. I have to beat Beckett. I have to be the one chosen for this job. The actual drill we plan to use is being finalized at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab right now, so today we'll be working with a smaller prototype. But first, let's warm up. Give me a twist dive followed by a 200-meter freestyle. Are we racing? I ask the lieutenant, already grinning at the prospect. The first nephew is about to get crushed. Yes, Leo, you can take the 10-meter board. I can't resist a smirk in Beckett's direction as I climb up to the higher diving board while he is relegated to the 3-meter. As I step up to the ledge, I glance down at the prick mark on my arm from last night's RRB shot, wondering if Naomi was right about it. Will I feel different in the pool again? I have my answer as soon as I hit the water. My skin is vibrating, my insides pulsing with the sensation of something coming to life within me, something faster than human. And as I fly through the pool, I think of the word Naomi used, amphibious. The way I move underwater without needing a breath, there does seem to be something almost amphibious about me now. I touch the wall, ready to lean back and wait for Beckett to catch up. But then I see, he's only a few strokes behind me. How is that possible? Well done, both of you, Lieutenant Barnes calls out, not looking nearly as stunned as he should be, considering we both just swam faster than Olympians. What is going on here? Lieutenant Barnes, Beckett calls out from his lane opposite mine. I've been working on that breath-holding technique we talked about, and I've gotten pretty good. Let me show you? Sure. Lieutenant Barnes nods, and Beckett hoists himself out of the pool and approaches my diving board, the 10-meter. A chill runs through my veins as Beckett executes a near-perfect backflip and stays underwater, the lieutenant gleefully calling out each minute he stays under. He makes it a full 7 minutes, not as long as my 15-plus, but an unprecedented improvement over his last 2-minute hold. And as I watch Beckett break through the surface and speed to the end of the lane, it's obvious that I'm not the only one benefiting from the strange side effects of the RRB. Naomi was right. There is far more to the RRB than we've been told. Once again, I remember Elena's warning words. But now I'm beginning to have an idea of what the ISTC had in mind. The kind of weapons we are intended to be.
20. Naomi. The 12 of us arrive in the altitude chamber to find General Sokolov waiting for us at the center of the ice, standing beside a man we haven't seen before. A heap of aluminum and canvas lies at their feet, folded up like a parachute, and I wonder if we're in for another extreme activity. Is parachuting over Houston next on the agenda? But then the general introduces her guest as Mr. Anthony Nolan from Bigelow Aerospace, and I feel a flicker of excitement. I've been following Bigelow science ever since I was a kid. Now that we're getting so close to departure, today is about learning how to live day-to-day in deep space, General Sokolov begins. Bigelow Aerospace has done a remarkable job of building an expandable habitat for the final six on Europa. She gestures to the folded materials on the ice. It doesn't look like much now, but once inflated, it just might rival some of your own homes on Earth. The habitat is built to withstand all the elements, provide radiation and ballistic protection, and remain in mint condition for 20 years, Mr. Nolan adds. And today you're going to learn how to assemble it once you land on Europa. Leo gives me a gentle nudge and a grin that makes my heart constrict. I know what he's saying with his smile. This could be ours. But I can't let my mind go there yet. I can't let myself contemplate a world without my family. Just as I can't imagine living a world away from Leo now that I've found him. There's only one way this can end in my favor. And it's all out of my hands. So that stuff would make up our entire home for the next 20 years? Beckett asks, eyeing the yards of aluminum and canvas. Clearly, it's no White House. Due to space restrictions here in the altitude chamber, we are only inflating one room of your habitat today. The crew community room, otherwise known as a den, Mr. Nolan answers. However, the tools and science are the same for one room and module as they are for the entire 1,800-square-foot Europa habitat. You'll just need to be prepared for a long day of working the pressure equalization valve. He points to a steel spigot that runs the length of the ice floor, nearly blending in with it. Who wants to give me a hand? I will, I volunteer, curious to try it, and he beckons me over. Once we're at the center of the ice, he instructs me to hold up one end of the canvas while he grasps the other, and then he grabs the valve with his free hand, feeding bursts of air into the hole in the canvas. A popping sound echoes through the chamber as it slowly inflates. It sounds like we're microwaving popcorn, I remark, watching as the canvas expands. Mr. Nolan chuckles. It sure does. Here, have a go at it. He hands me the valve, and as I press the trigger, a surge of air blasts into the canvas with surprising strength. Nice, I say, smiling at my handiwork. We now have almost half of a room standing. The rest of the 12 each take a turn at the valve, and as I watch the yards of material transforming into a full-size room, I am reminded of what I love about science. From almost nothing, we have created something, something that can support human beings for 20 years. It's like magic. In fact, sometimes I think that's exactly what science is, the magic we look for in stories, without realizing that it exists in all the inventions and creations around us. As the hour draws to a close, we stand back to admire our 100-square-foot inflated room. It's hard to believe it used to be just a heap of fabric. Would this really shield us from all the elements? Minka, the finalist from Ukraine, asks as she pokes its soft exterior. I mean, if we ever experienced on Europa anything like the storms and disasters we've had to deal with here on Earth, would this habitat be enough to protect us? It looks so light. The habitat is far more durable than it appears, and these materials were chosen with ultimate protection in mind, Mr. Nolan assures us. But remember, the recent destruction of most of our Earth was a man-made tragedy. Right now, Europa is a pure, untamed wilderness of ice that you will need to terraform, make habitable, and then protect. We learned the hard way on Earth that no amount of technology or wealth is worth polluting and destroying our planet over. You can't afford to make the same mistake on Europa. Finally, one of the authority figures here is speaking to something I believe in. Europa shouldn't be blindly colonized. It needs to be preserved. And if I'm right about Europa's intelligent life, as I'm certain I am, how are we supposed to protect and maintain the purity of this new environment if the very thing to protect it from just might be us? Once again, I reach the same conclusion. Earth is where it's safest, both for us humans and for Europa's undiscovered life. That night, I stare at the flash drive in my hands, knowing that this is the moment. I've waited long enough, analyzed and triple-checked every bit of code, and I've even covered my tracks by programming my tablet's IP address to reroute to a fake street address in Texas if traced. There's nothing left for me to do now but finish the hack. Of course, even with all my careful planning, the risks remain. If my work isn't quick and clean, I could compromise Dot. And if Dr. Takumi or General Sokolov senses something amiss with the robot's systems, they could run a malware scan and find evidence of my tampering. They won't necessarily know it was me, but as the only engineer here, I am the obvious culprit. If I get caught, I'll be thrown in jail for treason, maybe even tried as an adult. But if I don't attempt this, the world will never know about the extraterrestrials, and will be sending 6 human lives straight into their path. There is no question what I must do. I plug the drive into my tablet and enter my algorithm to unlock the AIOS software. It takes longer than I expected, 20 minutes of sweating in front of the screen as I work the code, until finally, yes! I cover my mouth with my hand, both thrilled and slightly terrified to see that it worked. My screen fills with Dot's monitoring signals and functions, the kind of access granted only to ISTC higher-ups. All I have to do now is type in my commands. I take a moment to consider the best way to receive the data I need from Dot. The easiest method with the least amount of risk would be to instruct the robot to send the files directly to my tablet. But this rudimentary device I brought doesn't have the storage space or capability to receive such advanced files on top of the AIOS software. There's no chance of me getting back into the robotics lab either, which means I need Dot to bring the files to me. Using binary code, I type in a command for the robot. Download all data on biosignatures from Europa. Bring the results to the private room of finalist Naomi Ardalan before morning. Discuss with no one. After I hit send and tuck the flash drive back in its hiding place, another challenge awaits, disabling the security camera in our hallway. I think quickly, weighing my options. There's no clear-cut way to stop the film from rolling without access to the ISTC computer that controls the cameras, but maybe I could blind the lens. I rush to my backpack, retrieving the pouch Sam refers to as my mad scientist kit, filled with odds and ends that are capable of pulling off an experiment on the fly. I rummage through it, momentarily considering petroleum jelly to blur the lens instead, until my hands close around something even better, my mini LED flashlight. That'll do the trick. I throw on a hoodie and then, gathering my courage, I open the door and steal through the dark. The main flaw with this plan is that it requires me to shine an ultra-powerful light straight ahead to not only blind the lens, but also obscure my face as I approach the camera. Hardly subtle if anyone else happens to be wandering the dorm in the middle of the night. I just have to pray that I'm the only one on our floor who is daring, or foolish, enough to be up past curfew. I make my way toward the blinking camera, my heartbeat echoing in my ears. And then, in one quick motion, I blast the LED light directly overhead, creating a lens flare. I hold the flashlight aloft for as long as my nerves allow, until I'm certain the lens is shot. And then I switch off the brightness and pick up my pace, tearing through the dark back to my room. I'm nearly there when I hear it, the sound of something moving behind me. I whirl around, but all I see are shadows cast by the furniture and framed photographs. It must have been my paranoid imagination. Except, as I push through the door into my room, I can almost swear I hear quickening footsteps. I stay up waiting until dawn, but there is no sign of Dot. As I shower and get dressed in a sleep-deprived fog, I wonder if I made some kind of mistake. Did I mess up when entering the algorithm or the machine-to-machine command? I replay my every move in my mind, but I can't pinpoint the flaw. Even if the robot was recharging on sleep mode, I know that it's programmed to wake up at a command. So, what went wrong? I rack my brain for a solution, another way to get the biosignatures from Dot. And then I remember that today's training schedule includes a group robotics operations session with the AIs. Could I maybe work this to my advantage? After breakfast, I pull Leo aside into the first private place I can find, an empty utility closet. "This is hot," he says, pulling me in for a kiss. As much as I'd love nothing more than to melt into Leo, I force myself to stay on track. "I have a favor to ask you," I say, pulling back from his kiss. "I need a moment alone with Dot to finish my plan. My only opportunity is during group training, but I'll need Sib and the others occupied." "Let me guess," Leo says, raking a hand through his hair. "You need to use my powers of distraction once again?" "I've already thought of something that should do the trick," I tell him. "But I should probably warn you that it might mark you as difficult in the robot's eyes. Then again, I questioned an actual NASA official about this at the very beginning, and I'm still here." Leo groans. "What are you getting at?" I take a deep breath, asking Sib point blank about the failed mission to Mars, Athena. Leo leans against the wall, his shoulders slumping. "Isn't there some other way? Something else I can do that isn't speaking out of turn or coming across like an instigator?" "Not unless you can think of something compelling enough to take everyone's eyes off Dot, and me, for a good 5 minutes. Plus, robotics ops is one of the only times it's just us finalists and the AIs, with no human instructors or team leaders around, which gives us our best chance." "I don't know," he sighs. "Even though I am starting to believe your theories about the RRB, I still believe in the mission, too. You know how much I want, need to make the final six, and Sib is a decision maker. If this could hurt my chances..." "I understand," I say quickly. "Don't worry." Maybe I am asking too much. "What will you do then?" "I'm not sure," I reply, "but I'll have to think of something. Maybe when I'm at one of my private training sessions in mission control, I can get near a Pleiades..." "The NASA supercomputer? No, no way." Leo holds up his hands, exhaling. "Let's just go with the plan that doesn't involve any more hacking. I'll do it. I'll ask the question." "You will?" I look at him in surprise and delight. He chuckles. "Yes, you weirdo. This better be worth it." I wrap my arms around his neck. "It will be. I have a feeling." We take our positions as soon as we reach the mission floor, with Leo standing right in front of Sib and me off to the side, the closest in the room to Dot. I try to make eye contact with the AI, but her head is swiveled away from me, watching Sib lead the session. "As you've seen in your simulations, there are points on our journey that require two of you to perform a spacewalk, while Dot and I, and the rest of the crew, remain inside. During that time, if ever there is a communication failure, we will rely on the new telemetry software in your spacesuits to monitor your status," Sib explains. "Today we'll be showing you how to read the telemetry signals and going over emergency procedures." Leo clears his throat. Is that what went wrong on the Athena mission?" he blurts out. "Was communication lost because the astronauts didn't have this caliber of spacesuit equipment?" I inch closer to Dot. Everyone is watching Leo and Sib. "Excuse me?" Sib utters after a pause. "Well, I mean, even though no official cause was ever given for the tragedy on Mars, there had to have been a reason, right?" Leo rambles. "I guess I'm just wondering what it was." Sib makes a series of mechanical sputtering sounds in response, and I can feel all the finalists in this room recognizing the same truth. The robots have clearly not been programmed to discuss the controversial Athena and its perished astronauts. But I can't think about that now. I seize my opportunity, quickly reaching for Dot's mechanical arm, and the AI turns to face me. "I hear you have something for me," I whisper to the machine. Dot's artificial eyes bore into mine. She expresses no surprise at my words, confirming that the AI did in fact receive my command. So then why... "Follow me," I say under my breath. I slip behind one of the hulking mock-up modules, out of Sib's and the group's line of sight. "I received a command on my tablet last night," I fib. "It said something about deciphering biosignatures and that you would be bringing them to me." "I am the backup machine," Dot says quietly, her voice like the female twin of Sib's crisp, clear tone. "Only my superior is authorized to deliver materials to the humans." "Logic, Naomi," I tell myself. "Remember, the robots work off logic." "But that's not true anymore, is it? Have you ever received a command by mistake?" Dot hesitates. "No." "That means something changed," I insist. "You were chosen for this task, Dot, not Sib, and only you and I are allowed to talk about it." I can see the wheels turning in Dot's machine mind, and I press on. One of the Europa mission leaders clearly needs both of us to do this. You can't go against your leaders, can you? I know that I can't. I give Dot an imploring look. What if this is some kind of test to see how well I can read the scientific elements, to determine if I should be one of the final six? They need your help finding out, and so do I. I half hate myself as I use logic-filled lies to sway the innocent robot. But as Dot looks back at me, registering my words, I can't help feeling a sprig of hope. This just might work.
21. Leo. The air seems to thicken around me as Sib fumbles at my question, and the rest of the finalists stare. I scan the room for Naomi and Dot, wondering when I can put an end to this, but they are both missing. Suddenly, Sib presses a round button on his mechanical arm, and within moments, General Sokolov comes bursting through the doors. My stomach drops. This can't be good, especially not if the general notices that Naomi and Dot are both absent. Hurry up, Naomi, I beg silently. General Sokolov paces toward us, her eyes flashing with irritation. Since when do we hijack training sessions with our own inappropriate questions? My skin burns under the glare of the general, and the stares of my competitors, most of whom appear to be reveling in seeing me get called out. Only Jian, Henry, and Sydney look at me with a hint of concern. But then I see Dot shuffle into view, followed a second later by Naomi filtering back into the crowd, and I breathe a sigh of relief. At least she managed to get through her part of the plan unscathed. Now I just have to find a way to remedy the situation on my end. I'm sorry, I tell the general and Sib. I didn't mean any disrespect whatsoever. I was genuinely just curious. So am I, an unexpected voice calls out. I think we all are. I turn and find that the voice relieving me from the spotlight belongs to Jian. I give him a grateful smile. The general freezes, and for a second I think she might explode on all of us. But then she heaves a sigh. Fine. Let's put the rumors to rest once and for all. I can feel Naomi trying to get my attention from across the room. She meets my eyes and mouths the words, thank you, putting her hand to her heart. I can tell you, from my insider's vantage point of working on the International Space Station at the time, that whatever preposterous stories you heard are complete nonsense, General Sokolov begins. There was no conspiracy. Russia didn't sabotage the mission for its own gain. I glance up, suddenly interested. I didn't know about any Russian conspiracy. But it must be enough of a story if the general immediately assumed that's what I was getting at. Nor did the crew starve to death, she adds. Not only did they have all the provisions they could fit into their habitat on Mars's surface, but the Athena's supply ship was permanently waiting in orbit with another 2 decades' worth of food, which the final six will now benefit from. She pauses. The tragedy was simply a failure of science, a failure we all learned from. What was the scientific failure exactly? Sydney calls out. I can read the subtext in her eyes. Could it happen again? Off the record, the general says. We instructed the Mars crew on how to build an enclosed Earth-like ecosystem on the planet shortly after they touched down. Because the astronauts all died at the same time, in the middle of the night, we have reason to believe an unexpected chemical reaction in the artificial space caused the oxygen to leak out while they were asleep. Her voice drops. They were gone before we could do anything. So they suffocated. I can feel my own throat closing up as I imagine the crew's nightmarish last moments. How did no one know about this? As if reading my thoughts, General Sokolov continues. Again, this is just a theory. Without a living crew to tend to the equipment, our monitor readings couldn't be deemed accurate, and NASA's and ROSCOM's public relations teams felt it was unfair to the families to float theories that may cause greater distress. She gives us a pointed look. I expect your cooperation in this. but I felt it was important for you to know that the likely cause of the Mars tragedy is something unique to that situation and will not present itself on Europa. We have enough real complications to prepare for. I can't have my potential final six distracted, worrying about impossibilities. How is it impossible on Europa? Henry calls out. The inflatable habitat is exactly why you'll be safe, General Sokolov finishes his sentence. We began working with Bigelow Aerospace after Mars, and it's a whole new level of protection. In addition, unlike Mars, we don't need to create an artificial ecosystem. Europa has the key ingredient of water. All we have to do is drill through the ice and get to it. She glances at Sib. Speaking of which, you all have a training session to return to. Now that I've answered your questions, I hope this will be the last time we discuss the Athena mission. As she saunters out of the room, it occurs to me that others here must have been questioning her about this before me. Otherwise, why would she give in and tell us the truth so quickly? There's just one thing she left out, Jian mutters behind me. The Dr. Takumi connection. Did you know he didn't advance to power until Mars happened? I turn around, staring at Jian in surprise. Leaving the mission floor for our next training session, I feel someone push my shoulder.
What was that about, Italian? Getting cold feet?
Beckett gives a mocking laugh.
Eager to go home to Mommy and Daddy and avoid big bad space?
I spin around, my insides burning with fury at the mention of the family and home I no longer have.
You wish. I'm not going anywhere.
The bigger question is, why do you act so high and mighty when you're obviously the one afraid of me?
Please. Beckett gives me a scornful look. You're not a threat.
Right. That's why you attempted to cut me loose from 10,000 feet in the air. Beckett stops short, the color draining from his face. He thought I didn't know. He must have thought it was a secret moment that only he and his dark conscience would ever remember.
What the hell?
He wrinkles his nose, making like I'm the crazy one. But I know better. I saw you try to mess with my harness. You would have killed me if you could. The only reason you're not trying anything like that here is so you don't get cut. I lean forward. So tell me, Beckett, what is so terrifying for you back at the White House that you'd try to kill me in order to stay away? For a split second, I think Beckett might actually own up to everything. But then he glowers at me.
You don't know what you're talking about, he says before turning his back.
I'm still watching him stalk away when I feel a hand on my arm. What was that about? Naomi murmurs in my ear.
I'll tell you when we're alone.
Speaking of, Lark says we have a free hour between training and dinner. Meet me at our spot? She asks. I have something to tell you.
I nod, the thought of alone time with her wiping Beckett from my mind. I'll be there.
I climb the steps of the telescope tower to find Naomi already waiting, leaning her elbows on the balcony railing as she looks up at the stars. She turns at the sound of my footsteps and gives me a sheepish smile.
Hey,
I greet her, kissing her forehead.
What did you want to tell me?
She looks at me as if in awe.
You mean you're not angry?
About what? The whole thing with the general?
Yeah.
She laces her fingers in mine. Here I was, all prepared to apologize, and you're not even mad.
Well, considering I let you off the hook after pulling something way riskier the night of the storm, I think we've established that I don't know how to be mad at you.
Clearly I need to work on that. I grin. But I am curious to hear the apology you planned out.
Okay, yeah, let me say it. She stands up straighter. I didn't expect Sib to bring in the general. I know how important this mission is to you, and I'm really, really sorry if I caused any sort of red flag by your name. But,
she takes a deep breath,
if it turns out I'm right, not just about the RRB, but about what the space conspirator has been writing all along, then I'm not afraid to say it. I want you to stay on Earth. I want you safe.
I touch her cheek, momentarily lost for words.
It's been a long time since somebody cared this much for me. And I'd almost forgotten, after losing my family, what it feels like to truly matter to someone.
Well, at least one interesting thing came out of your plan, I say when I find my voice. Jian told me something General Sokolov left out of her explanation about Mars. Apparently, Dr. Takumi accelerated to power right after the Athena tragedy.
Naomi's eyes widen.
Wow. That is some seriously shady timing. She leans back against the balcony railing, thinking. If there's more to it, maybe we'll find out when... If Dot comes through. Provided I don't get arrested for treason first.
I stare at her, marveling at how she can speak so matter-of-factly about that possibility.
So you're really not afraid of getting caught? Is there anything that scares you?
Naomi gives me a half-smile before glancing away.
The thought of losing the people I love, especially my little brother.
She takes a breath.
I'm not just scared of that, I'm terrified. So I'm not fearless. And whatever I do that may seem that way, it's all for them.
I nod, realizing as I gaze at her that Naomi's words make her even more beautiful to me.
What about you? She asks. You don't seem at all scared of the mission, even with the laundry list of risks.
Yeah, well, I used to have the exact same fear as you. But then my worst fear came true. And for a while, that made me unafraid of anything, including, and especially, death. I swallow hard. But now I know what it's like to be afraid of losing something again. I've known that feeling since I found you.
Naomi's eyes well up. She pulls me close, answering my words with a kiss.
Our kisses start out soft and tender. And then her fingers move beneath my shirt, running down my back, and suddenly we're sliding down to the tower floor together, kissing like it's our last night in this world.
22. Naomi. I'm in the middle of a perfect dream when I hear the sound. I'm back home, sitting at the old dining table that still has Sam's and my initials carved into the wood, and my loved ones are seated around me. My brother, our parents, and Leo, too. But then a rhythmic series of beeps seeps into my consciousness, interrupting the golden moment. What's that noise? I ask, glancing around the table. What noise, Azizem? Mom gives me a funny look. You know what it is, Sam says. It's Morse code, saying you have to wake up. He leans over and shakes my shoulders. Wake up! I sit bolt upright, my eyes snapping open at the beeping in my room. Dot is in front of me, shuffling her way across the floor toward my bed. I cover my mouth to keep from crying out in amazement. The plan actually worked! Dot stops dead center, facing my bed. That's when I see that the AIOS screen on her chest chassis is all lit up and flashing with symbols. But it's more than just images. There's also a sound coming from the screen, a vibrational humming, only the pitch and tone are all wrong. It's a foreign sound that turns my body cold, that sends pins and needles prickling through my skin. The robot beeps again, urging me and Morse to copy down what I see on the screen. I know why Dot isn't speaking verbally, in case anyone on either side of these walls happens to be up at this hour. I've made the AI believe this is a secret, crucial task from one of the mission leaders, and I feel a stab of guilt at the way I've misled Dot. But this is too important for me to hesitate. I switch on the light and run to my desk, grabbing a notepad and pen. My pen flies across the paper as I copy down one chemical symbol and physics formula after another, not stopping to register what I'm notating, until an image fills the screen, and I almost fall out of my chair. It's a sketch of what appears to be a cell, its insides punctured with three nuclei, just like the RRB. I'm shaking as I finish copying the figures on the screen, and then, finally, it turns dark. Dot shuffles back to the door, and as I watch her retreating form, I whisper, "Thank you." The cell image is a revelation enough, but I still have numerical data to decipher. I spend the next 2 hours studying it and unscrambling the formulas until I finally solve the main riddle with a heart-stopping flick of my pen. Chlorophyll, methane, Europa. Chlorophyll and methane found on Europa. The room sways as I stare at my notes, and for a split second I am outside of my own body, looking down at the surreal scene of my discovery. Because where there is chlorophyll and methane, there is life. These are the biosignatures I was looking for. And with the RRB cells matching the idiosyncratic image of the cell in this data, that proves my hypothesis. We are being injected with bacteria from Europa's alien life. And it's making some of us more like them, as proven by Leo in the diving pool. It's making some of us see them, as evidenced by Suki's cries and Callum's breakdown. As for the rest of us, we may never know how deep its effects go until we land. I jump out of my seat, too overcome to sit still. This goes beyond any secret I thought Dr. Takumi was keeping. It's on another level from the space conspirators' theories. But how could NASA and all the reputable space agencies allow this, and why? Unless, could it be that the space agencies as a whole don't know? Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov have jurisdiction over the robots, which certainly makes it possible for them to keep the data secret. Did they? And what is their endgame? One thing is for sure, I can't wait till morning to share this news with Leo. I'm pretty sure I'll explode if I have to keep it inside a minute longer. I know we agreed to resist the temptation of sneaking into each other's rooms, but compared to everything else I've been up to here at ISTC, stealing into the boys' dorm seems practically quaint. I slide my feet into slippers and grab the flashlight under my bed. I can feel my heart palpitating as I make my way down the corridor to the fork that separates the girl's side from the boys, imagining what Leo will say to my discovery, what the world will say when I release the data. Maybe I can find a way to get it to someone like Dr. Wagner to shield my family from the fallout of my hacking. My flashlight hits against another yellow beam. I jump back, fear rising in my throat. I'm not alone. Someone is standing across from me in the dorm corridor, shining a flashlight of his own. Beckett Wolf. He tilts his beam of light straight into my face, catching me red-handed. Sneaking out of your room after curfew, I could report you for this, he says with a sly smile. He looks all wrong, leaning against the wall like he's been here for hours, like he's been waiting for something. I could say the same about you, I retort, but Beckett just shrugs. I'm just getting some air. I'm not the one trying to sneak into my secret boyfriend's room. The breath returns to my lungs. Could he only know about Leo and not about Dot? I raise myself to my full height, giving Beckett my best scornful expression. Don't be stupid. I couldn't sleep and just thought I'd take a walk. It's not any more scandalous than that. I turn on my heel, and as I walk away, I hear Beckett singing something familiar under his breath. When I am king, you will be first against the wall. With your opinion, which is of no consequence at all. The haunting melody continues in my mind as I hurry back to my room. I know that song. It's a classic. So why do I have a creeping feeling of dread? And then the title flashes in my mind, making me wonder if Beckett saw more than he let on. He was singing a Radiohead song called Paranoid Android.
23. Leo. Instead of the mirror screen alarm, I wake up to the sound of someone flinging open my bedroom door. I scramble upright, covering my bare chest as Lark steps in. No breakfast in the cafeteria today, she says by way of greeting. Dr. Takumi called a press conference in the media room. Get dressed and meet your fellow finalists there right away. Is everything okay? But she's already on to the next room before I can get my question out. I climb out of bed, an onset of nerves kicking in. Something tells me that whatever this is, it's going to be bad. I throw on my uniform and hurry out the door, catching up with Henry and the other Russian finalist, Evgeny, at the end of the boys' corridor. Do you guys know what's going on? I ask as we rush down the stairs. No clue, Henry answers, and Evgeny shakes his head. but they both look almost as worried as I feel. We arrive in the media room to find a grim-faced Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov standing at the foot of the stage before a half-dozen news cameras. The sight of outsiders infiltrating our training camp bubble gives me a shudder of foreboding. More than half of my fellow finalists fill the seats in front of the stage, and I scan their faces looking for Naomi. But there's no sign of her. I follow Henry and Evgeny into the second row and slide in next to Dev Khanna, leaving the aisle seat beside me empty for her.
Any idea what's happening?
I glance at Dev, hoping against the odds that he might have some reassuring info, but he shakes his head. We wait silently, with him watching the stage and me eyeing the door, until he nudges me in the ribs.
Look.
I follow Dev's gaze to the opposite side of the aisle, where General Sokolov leads a stumbling Dot toward the stage. My mouth falls open as I watch Dot struggling to walk like some kind of robot toddler. I hear Sydney Pearl try to greet Dot, and I see the robot stare at her blankly in return. As if she's never seen her before. A pit of dread sets in my stomach.
What's going on?
It's Naomi.
I breathe a sigh of relief. As long as she's here in the audience with us, she couldn't have been caught. Right? I point out the sight of the clumsy, infantile Dot limping her way up the stage, helped along by the general. Dev leans over to the two of us.
It looks like they reset Dot.
Naomi closes her eyes, shaking her head.
Reset? I repeat.
What does that mean exactly?
But before they can answer me, Dr. Takumi steps up to the microphone. He leans forward, staring into the eyes of the cameras.
Early this morning, the Johnson Space Center was the victim of an attempted security breach. I want to assure everyone that no harm was done. However, we had to act quickly. Seeing as the security breach occurred in one of our most classified high-level robots, we had no choice but to restore the AI Dot to her original settings before she could be compromised any further. All of her stored memory, data, and functions have been scrubbed. Dot will need to relearn her skills and will no longer accompany the final six to Europa.
My stomach drops.
Naomi grabs my arm as a collective gasp fills the air.
I can tell from her shallow breaths that she is on the verge of panic just like me, and I force myself to keep a poker face, even as I feel my body twitching, threatening to give us away.
However, there will still be two robots on the mission, Dr. Takumi continues. While it's less than ideal, a backup AI we recently finished testing will take Dot's place and serve alongside Sib.
One of the reporters raises his hand.
Do you have any idea who could be responsible for such a treacherous act?
Naomi digs her nails into my arm, and I brace myself for the worst.
This is it. We're caught, and they're going to take her away.
That information has not been confirmed, Dr. Takumi says coolly. However, we have reason to suspect someone in particular.
He pauses, and I can't breathe, can't watch anymore.
I stare down at Naomi's hand, my mind torturing me with thoughts of what they'll do to her. How can I protect her?
We're fairly certain it was a former ally of ours. It's no secret that Dr. Greta Wagner has been unsuccessfully attempting to hijack the Europa mission ever since we cut ties with Wagner Enterprises.
Dr. Takumi's voice barely disguises his rage. My body sags with shock. He doesn't even suspect us. And of all people, he thinks it was that scientist Naomi idolizes, whose book is currently sitting by my bed?
I glance at Naomi,
finding my own guilt and astonishment reflected in her eyes.
There's something else, Dr. Takumi says, and this time I could swear he is looking straight at the two of us. We'll be making our selections for the final six earlier than previously announced. Tomorrow, in fact. This security breach has only highlighted the time-sensitive nature of our mission.
24. Naomi. How could I have been so wrong? I stare at the hopeless spectacle of this new dot, and I can feel the bile rising in my throat. How could I have messed up on such a colossal scale? I thought I